Court will now proceed to the third case, Frontier Insurance v. Hitchcock. Mr. Plopper.
May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Plopper. I practice in Indianapolis, Indiana, and representing three individual indemnitors in this matter, Hitchcock, Weitzel, and Durham. After the drama of the last two cases, we've now got a question of contract interpretation, so we'll slow down the heart rates a little bit and get into that. In 1999, my clients entered into a general agreement of indemnity at the time that they were selling or purchasing a business from individuals down in South Carolina. This general agreement of indemnity was a rather simple document that had three paragraphs of import, and although there were only three, it has raised questions of ambiguity that have led us over a nine-year chase to see whether or not it needs to be performed. In this instance, paragraph one, which is really the most operative paragraph, obligates the indemnitors to reimburse Frontier for any loss that it pays.
You know, why is this a final judgment when there is a pending request in the district court that the court specify how much the indemnitors have to deposit?
That is after the fact, Your Honor. What happened was in March, Judge Barker's order was certified under 54B as a final order with no just reason for delay. It's an order of specific performance. Specifically, the second question or the bifurcated question concerned attorney's fees and the collection of attorney's fees.
So well, it's not money that would have to be paid, too. That goes to that's the same question that Judge Rovner asked. Why? It doesn't look like everything is done in the district court on this issue.
On this particular issue,
if the district court, for instance, said your client had to pay $200, I doubt whether you'd be here.
True. I mean, that's true. It would have been a final order if it had been.
Maybe then that is a final order, but you wouldn't have taken an appeal on it. You'd be very happy.
Your Honor, we were faced with a situation where the district court declared it to be a final judgment, issued a judgment, declared it to be a final judgment, certified it under 54B. If we had ignored that or tried to interpret something else of it, we'd been waiving our client's rights to appeal. We're left with a situation.
You can appeal at any time after there is a final judgment in the case. You can all orders that percolated up to the final order are subject to appeal.
Well, Frontier's position in this, and as why the order is not final and appealable at this point, is that the court did not specify an amount to be performed under the specific performance and amount to, and that is precisely why this is final and why we're here, because the court really couldn't determine it. The reasoning of the court we maintain was faulty in that there needs to be an actual determination, a proven fact and amount before there's a determination as to what the deposit should be. That's our premise.
Let's assume for the moment that we agree with Judge Barker, you know, that the indemnitors have an obligation to make a deposit now. Is the amount of the deposit an all or nothing proposition in your view, or might the court have the discretion to say, given the pending rehabilitation proceedings, that Frontier ultimately might not have to pay the full amount of the judgment on the surety
dilemma
bond, so some lesser amount, you know, is appropriate to deposit?
The dilemma for the district court is in trying to set a deposit amount, it's purely speculative. The fact of the matter is Frontier is in rehabilitation, and the amount that at the end of the day, whether it's paid from a deposit or paid strictly in reimbursement, The amount that's going to be paid is what Frontier pays out through that rehabilitation.
Yeah, but paragraph...
And that's a, that's kind of a Hobson's choice for the court.
Paragraph 3, you know, of the agreement indicates that Frontier can demand a deposit before it may be required to make any payments. So why doesn't that suggest the obligation to make a deposit ripens before Frontier
Because, Your Honor, that interpretation only reads the first half of paragraph 3. If you look at this paragraph, it has no punctuation whatsoever. It is a single sentence.
I know it's a mess, but if the indemnitors don't have to make a deposit until Frontier actually makes payment on the bond, then what's the point of a deposit? It's not a deposit.
The point of deposit was in order, and also the language of fact and amount, was to enable sureties to escape principals who were trying to avoid payment, claiming that the surety paid something they shouldn't have paid, etc. The prima facie evidence clauses, which are very prevalent in surety bonds, is to enable them to facilitate their recoupment of their loss. And this sentence, if you look at it in the light of 1999, when we entered into the paragraph or entered into this general agreement of indemnity, it is obvious that anybody reading that would say, okay, it's a reimbursement contract, and we're supposed to reimburse them for what they pay out.
You know, requiring a deposit now, it seems, to me, ensures that Frontier has the funds on hand to cover its liability once the rehabilitator in New York determines exactly what Frontier must pay.
Well, it has funds on hand for what? In other words, there is a specific rehabilitation going on. The obligees under this bond, who have nothing to do with us, we have no privity with them whatsoever, the obligees under this bond have to go to the rehabilitation court to collect from Frontier. If we put a deposit up, which is now going to be held in Indiana, in district court in Indiana, we put this deposit up, I would submit, what's the purpose? You know, it's really to be determined in the New York rehabilitation as to what the amount is going to be. If you put it there, is this a fund that enables this particular claimant to escape the full faith and credit that's being afforded to the rehabilitation?
But, you know, your argument seems to me to say that the obligation becomes ripe only once Frontier actually has to make good on its liability. If that's so, then the deposit requirement is virtually meaningless.
I would agree that it's in this circumstance, given the circumstance of the rehabilitation, that the deposit is in fact meaningless. If you look at cases where, like the Far Western case out of the Northern District of Indiana, where a deposit was required with a insurance company in rehabilitation, you had a contract that was much more precise in demanding that a deposit be made for specific amounts. And also in that case, there had been a determination by the rehabilitator as to what the reserve amount should be to pay the particular claim.
But the provision,
there's never been a reserve established by...
But the provision states that Frontier may demand a deposit before it makes payment on the bond. And, you know, the whole point of a deposit is to cover prospective liability.
Well, then you would turn to the case, what should the amount be? Okay, is the prospective liability is obviously going to be determined through this rehabilitation? And it may be a very low amount. Okay, this is a 9-year rehabilitation. No plan has ever been filed. Okay, there is nothing that has indicates that they're ever going to emerge from rehabilitation.
Potter?
Yes, sir.
In the prospective July 20th, 2010 status conference ever occur in this case?
It only to put off the hearing or trial on the attorney fee question until it's scheduled for March of 2011. I'll reserve for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Roma?
May it please the court, counsel. I believe that Judge Rovner has hit on exactly the issues that are relevant on both of these.
Ah, but wait. I want to ask you the very same question that I asked your colleague. Is the amount of the deposit an all or nothing proposition, or might the district court have the discretion to order a deposit in some amount less than Frontier's full liability?
Your Honor, we think that the district court has the discretion to order a specific deposit in an amount that the district court feels is necessary to protect Frontier's interests.
So in other words, it's not an all or nothing proposition.
Well, certainly, you know, Your Honor, you know, we specifically sought a specific amount, but you know, we don't argue that we are not arguing that the district court is bound to award that specific amount as a deposit. The district court always has discretion to determine what a fair amount would be to hold, and that's one of the jurisdictional problems we have. The district court didn't determine that in the judgment granting summary judgment on the specific performance issue, and has not really been given an opportunity yet to determine that. Mr. Plopper has indicated, well, how does the district court come up with that number? That's an issue that can be argued before the district court. But I think that before we decide whether the district court has properly granted specific performance, the district court has to at least been given the opportunity and to have made a determination that there is a specific amount that has to be deposited.
What role, if any, might the indemnity agreement play in the rehabilitation proceedings? For example, the indemnitors make the deposit, your client decision. Would the rehabilitator consider that money to be one of Frontier's available assets to the deposit? Have any relevance at all to an assessment of what Frontier has to pay on the bond judgment or to its other creditors?
Your Honor, I will have to confess, I am not involved in the rehabilitation process. That's handled by counsel up in New York, familiar with New York rehabilitation law. However, I would think that the amount of the deposit would not play a determination in whether or not the claim being asserted by the Spencers was a valid claim against the estate. The amount of the deposit may play a determination into whether or not that claim is ultimately going to get paid, as opposed on some basis other than a pro rata basis along with all other creditors. But I don't think it would play a part in determining whether or not the claim is a valid claim and in what amount the claim is a valid claim. I think Judge Rovner was also correct in the issues with regard to the decision of the district court on whether or not there is an enforceable requirement to deposit funds. The appellants, the indemnitors, would have the court simply ignore the language that says that Frontier can make a demand for deposit before it is required to make payment. As the district court recognized, accepting the argument of the indemnitors in this case would be nonsensical. It would essentially mean that Frontier has to make payment first before it's entitled to a deposit. But if it's made payment, then it wouldn't be entitled to a deposit. It would be entitled to indemnity under paragraph 1. Furthermore, the deposit is specifically stated in paragraph 3 as a deposit to meet Frontier's liability. Well, if Frontier has already made payment of the claim, it doesn't have a liability anymore. It has a loss. So again, the deposit would be, you know, accepting their argument would be to simply write the language about the deposit out of the indemnity agreement. Now, the indemnitors make a big argument with regard to the prima facie language. And we contend that the prima facie language in paragraph 3 is in fact consistent with the language requiring a deposit. We have to remember that there are two separate obligations here. There's an obligation to indemnify after a loss has occurred. There's an obligation to make a deposit. The deposit is there to essentially, or the obligation to make a deposit is there to essentially protect Frontier from a situation where after a liability has been incurred, where the indemnitors have, do not dissipate their assets, where once a loss is actually paid, Frontier goes back to the indemnitors and there's no money left. So the requirement for a deposit is to protect against that. The prima facie language in paragraph 3 is there to provide that once a deposit is made, if Frontier is going to use that those funds to pay an obligation, to pay a loss, to pay a liability, then it still has to prove to the indemnitors that it has paid that liability in good faith. The purpose of the prima facie language is there to, you know, act as an evidentiary tool to allow Frontier, you know, to meet Frontier's burden of proving that it's made these payments in good faith and that these payments that were obligated to be made. So it is consistent with the language requiring a deposit because it takes into account what happens with the deposit after the deposit is made. There's nothing in the prima facie language, nothing in the indemnity agreement at all, that makes Frontier's payment, Frontier's producing a voucher or evidence of payment, a precondition to the requirement to make a deposit. And again, we have to keep in mind, we're just talking about a deposit. We're talking about essentially them placing collateral with Frontier. If Frontier never has to pay a loss, that collateral goes back to the indemnitors. If Frontier does have to pay a loss, they have to prove that loss, and that's when they bring in vouchers or other evidence of payment.
But then why is this a final judgment? Oh. I know the judge certified it, but if the requirement was to pay a $200 deposit right now, we wouldn't be here.
That's correct. That's correct.
And if the judge could pick out, you know, based on the evidence, any number here, as I see it, why, well, without any number, is this a properly certified Rule 54 appeal?
Judge Evans, let me, you know, first of all, retract something I just said. We may still be here if the judge had determined that the proper amount was $200, because Frontier may be appealing at that
point.
Yeah, you
might be appealing now.
Yeah, gee, it needs to be more. But we agree. We agree that it is not a final judgment and that we shouldn't be here at this point. We should be waiting for the district court to determine a specific amount that has to be deposited. Right now, Frontier's in a situation where we've got a, quote, judgment that we have no way of enforcing. We can't go out and attach assets of the indemnitors because there's no amount for us to attach. We can't go to the court and say, Judge Barker, hold the indemnitors in contempt for failing to comply with your obligation, because the obligation at this point is still uncertain. There's no how would they fail to comply when you haven't set an amount that has to be deposited? So we agree this that the judgment of the district court is not final at this point, and that regardless of the Rule 54B certification, jurisdiction does not exist in this court to decide this appeal. My time is coming close to being up. If there are any other questions, I'd be glad to address.
What would the district court have to do to come up with an exact number?
Well,
are we talking only about a ministerial act at some point?
No, I think we are talking about a discretion, an act of discretion on the part of the district court. I think we're talking about a situation where the district court has to look at the amount of the judgment awarded by the South Carolina court, which is in principle $1.559 million plus there's interest that's accrued on that since then, has to look at the rehabilitation of Frontier, and has to look at various factors and make a determination as to, you know, what amount fairly protects Frontier and fairly enforces the provision of the indemnity agreement requiring a deposit.
Well, but it is that 1.55 figure, right?
Well, that's the amount of the judgment.
Right.
Now, if the district court were to determine that that judgment would be the amount that Frontier would have to pay after the Spencers have gone through the rehabilitation process, then I think that the district court would properly determine that the amount to be deposited should be $1.559 million. If the district court determines that, despite the fact that there's a judgment by a district court that's been affirmed on appeal by a federal circuit court, the amount that Frontier would ultimately be required to pay is some amount less, then I think the district court has the discretion to make that determination.
And that, well, let's hypothesize for a second on that. Suppose that last scenario plays out, and the amount is less than the 1.55. Won't that be a fixed number?
It would be.
Yeah, obviously. But I mean, computed by the fact that Frontier had to pay less. So I mean, what I understand the argument on discretion, but what isn't that really just an accounting matter? It's just math. I you know, it's not like the discretion on sentencing someone to 2 or 4 years, is it?
It would be, except for the fact that the rehabilitation process has not gone forward with regard to the Spencer claim yet. So at this point, the district court still has to make some type of judgment as to, you know, what amount might we be likely to require, or what amount, you know, might the rehabilitation court determine that Frontier would have to pay. So it would not simply be a matter of throwing some numbers into a formula and coming up with something.
Yeah, but is the district court just awaiting the receipt of a new number? I mean, what kind of hearing would there be held in Indianapolis post the rehabilitation decision?
I think it would be more likely, arguments from counsel with respect to what number would fairly protect Frontier's interest with respect to the ultimate liability that may have to be paid.
Perhaps I'm not tracking, but it seems to me to be a pretty short argument by both counsel, because the district court would be presented, would it not, with a new number, so which would either subtract from the 1.55 or not.
I think that may be correct.
I'm just speaking as to the finality issue.
Sure.
I mean, what's left? I appreciate your response.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Plapper.
May it please the court, the 1.55 number really is not applicable to us and has nothing to do with the general agreement of indemnity. We are to indemnify against the bond itself, not some judgment in South Carolina that we've never been privy to. And the bond itself says that the amount that they'll pay is a reduced amount and nothing more than the reduced amount. That's a figure of about $921,000. So I think that to track the judgment there is really, I'll take my chances in district court on that one. But what I'd like to point out and why we think that if this is a final judgment, and I preclude that we have a mess on our hands here, we've argued this case twice, once in front of Judge Tinder and once in front of Judge Barker. In 2006, Tinder made a very distinct statement about our famous paragraph 3 when he said, fairly read, this language requires that the fact and amount of the liability be established before a deposit with Frontier by defendants is required.
Don't you wish you were on the panel?
What?
I said, don't you wish he were on the panel?
Yes, I did. I thought he might not be. Secondly, Judge Barker said she'd follow right along with the language and the prior estoppel from the earlier decision, but she came out exactly the opposite. And we think that is error. We think that the correct reading was just what Judge Tinder said, that you have to read this sentence with not even a semicolon. You have to read it as all in one, and that the fact and amount language modifies what the deposit should be. We think that the order of specific performance here is premature, just as it was back in 2006. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to